Action Center. I also ordered Diederik to send his 2nd Platoon, commanded by Lieutenant James L. Lane, to reinforce Bob Edwards' Charlie Company, which was thinly spread over 120 yards of the perimeter on the south and southeast sides. Says Edwards, the attachment of the 2nd Platoon was greatly appreciated. I placed it on my right flank, where it filled that critical gap between Alpha Company and my 3rd Platoon. Our ability to trade off platoons with other companies and work with them was important. As Lieutenant Lane's platoon began settling in, a shocking event occurred. Sergeant John Settlin had moved his men to some of the foxholes vacated by Charlie Company men when they shifted left.
I got everybody down and started scouting to my left to hook in with Charlie Company. As I started out, I heard one round sizzle over my head. I heard the crack of the rifle and the sizzle. I had never seen anybody or been that close to anybody who was hit before. The round struck Glenn Willard, our machine gunner, in the left side of his chest. I rushed to him. I thought a lot of Willard. He was a small man, but he never let anybody help him carry his M60 or the ammo. He was gurgling and his eyes rolled back in his head. It was almost like he was having a stroke.
Sedlin rolled Willard over and started pulling his web gear and his clothing off. He had a sucking chest wound, and I remembered training to treat that. I must have done it right, protected his wound, but when I tried to pick him up, my hand sort of disappeared in the lower portion of his back where the bullet came out. Lamont ran over to help. Tears were running down my face. I was yelling, "He's about to die on me." Willard was my first casualty, and I felt like I wasn't doing my job. A tall guy came over and picked Willard up in his arms and carried him to the medics in the battalion CP. The gravely wounded Willard survived. With the pall of smoke and dust choking the valley, twilight would be brief. We had only a little time to set up the nighttime perimeter around X-ray. In positioning the 5 infantry companies, I took several things into account. The fighting strength of each company, the need to defend the small 2-chopper landing zone, enemy routes of attack, and placing the Delta Company machine gun platoon with its 6 M60s where they could do the most good and the most damage. I wanted those machine guns in the more open, flat terrain on the eastern edge of the clearing. I now considered the toll this day's fighting had taken. Tony Nadal's Alpha Company had lost 3 officers and 31 enlisted men, killed and wounded, and now reported effective strength of 2 officers and 84 enlisted. John Herron's Bravo Company had lost 1 officer and 46 enlisted men killed or wounded, and was down to 4 officers and 68 enlisted men with 1 platoon. Herrick's trapped outside the perimeter. Those 2 companies were given smaller sectors than Bob Edwards's Charlie Company, which had lost only 4 casualties and was reporting a strength of 5 officers and 102 enlisted. Even so, I beefed up Charlie Company with Lieutenant Lane's platoon from Bravo Company's 2nd Battalion. Myron Diederik and his 2 other platoons were assigned to the sector northeast of the small landing zone to help protect the clearing, the 8 mortars, and the aid station command post supply dump near the termite hill. The battalion recon platoon was held back in a reserve assembly area close to my command post. I made certain the machine gun platoon was tightly tied to Bob Edwards' left flank in the southeast sector. At about 6:50 p.m., I radioed Matt Dillon to come into X-ray as soon as possible, bringing Hastings and Whiteside, 2 more radio operators, and as much ammo and water as they could carry on 2 Hueys. We now had good direct communications with brigade headquarters and no longer needed the command ship overhead relaying our radio traffic. This was thanks to 1st Sergeant Warren Adams of Delta Company, who brought in a RC-292 field antenna. Installed in a tall tree, the long antenna gave us the range to talk to brigade at the tea plantation, more than 25 miles away. Besides, this battle was far from over, and I now needed Dillon at my right hand to help me control the fight. With the fire support coordinators on the ground, we would also cut our response time in the fluid, fast-paced situation. For almost 8 hours, I had been involved in the minute-to-minute direction of the battle. Now I wanted to personally walk the perimeter and check the preparations for what promised to be a tough night and another tough day tomorrow. Just before dark, Sergeant Major Plumley and I broke away from the command post and set out to check the perimeter, talking with the troopers and getting a feel for the situation on the ground. What concerned me most was the morale of the men, how well the companies were tied in, their defensive fire plans, and the situation with ammunition and water supplies. Morale among the men was high, although there was understandable grief over the friends we had lost. The men I talked with realized that we were facing a fierce, determined enemy, but he had failed to break through our lines. They knew the fight wasn't over. I heard weary soldiers say things like, "We'll get him, sir, and they won't get through, sir." Their fighting spirit had not dimmed, and they made me proud and humble. In every one of my companies that had landed in this place this morning, there were 15 to 20 soldiers who had less than 2 weeks left to go in the army. Some of those men now lay dead, wrapped in ponchos near my command post. The rest of them were on that perimeter, standing shoulder to shoulder with their buddies, ready to continue the fight. With the coming of full darkness around 7:15 p.m., Plumlee and I moved back to the Termite Hill command post. When we got back, I checked on Sergeant Ernie Savage and his band of survivors in Herrick's cutoff platoon. The report came back by radio that they had taken no additional casualties and were hanging tough. I mulled over possible options for their rescue, a night attack, night infiltration to reinforce the platoon, or a fresh attempt to fight through to them early the next morning. They would be on all our minds this night, that brave handful of men, surrounded and alone in a sea of enemies. Chapter 11. Night Falls. If we are marked to die, we are enow to do our country loss, and if to live, the fewer men, the greater share of honor. Henry V, Act 4, Scene 3. The raging battle of the afternoon had faded to sporadic firing. The landing zone was set up for night operations, and the artillery and mortars had registered all around the perimeter. In the aid station, Sergeant Keaton and Sergeant Keith jury-rigged a small blacked-out tent of ponchos so they could safely use a light while working on the wounded. They were now well-stocked with morphine and bandages. About 5 p.m. we ran out of morphine, and Colonel Moore called back to brigade for additional supplies. By dark, we had received 125 or 130 styrets of morphine, says Keaton. Seems like every American unit in Vietnam heard our request and sent it to us. I had enough morphine when we got back to base camp to do us for the rest of the Vietnam War. UPI reporter Joe Galloway had spent the afternoon desperately trying to finagle his way into LZ X-ray without success. Galloway had been aboard Colonel Tim Brown's command chopper when I waved Brown off shortly after noon. At brigade headquarters, Galloway had lined up with the troopers of Bravo Company's 2nd Battalion and boarded a lift helicopter, but only briefly. Lieutenant Rick Rescorla says, "As we boarded the Hueys, a stocky journalist in a sand-colored beret with an M16 and camera jumped on one of our choppers. Major Pete Millay came over and pulled him off. We needed the spot for a company medic." Galloway shifted to LZ Falcon and there spotted Matt Dillon loading up the two resupply helicopters. He pleaded for a ride. Dillon said he couldn't make that decision but agreed to put it to me over the radio. I told Dillon that if Galloway was that crazy and there was room, he could bring him on in. During those walks in the sun around Plain May, I had gotten acquainted with Galloway. He was different from most of the other reporters who flocked to the 1st Cavalry in those early days. He stuck with the battalion through good and bad, rolling up in a poncho on the ground and staying the night instead of scrambling on a supply Huey and heading back to a warm bunk and a hot meal in the rear. During my time in Vietnam, I met only two other reporters who displayed the same grit: Bob Post of the Associated Press and Charlie Black of the Columbus, Georgia Ledger-Enquirer. There was one other thing. I had concluded that the American people had a right to know what their sons were doing in this war, on the ground, in the field. I welcomed visiting reporters to my battalion and later to my brigade. I told them they could go anywhere they wanted with my troopers, with only two restrictions. Don't put out any information that will endanger us, and don't interfere with operations. I never had cause to regret that openness. Shortly after 9 p.m., Gruz Crandall came up on the Pathfinder's radio. His message to me, via Lieutenant Dick Tift, a vigorous young Californian who had brought in a team to run the helicopter landings, was that he and Big Ed Freeman were 5 minutes out,
two slicks escorted by two gunships, bringing in Dylan and Party plus more ammo and water. As the helicopters dropped in on the final approach, Matt Dillon looked out toward Chu Pong. Plainly visible along the mountain slopes were hundreds of small lights winking in the dark forests. He also spotted a blinking light just below the top of the mountain directly above X-ray, and a second blinking light on the northern slope of a 1,312-foot peak 1 mile due south. I am convinced that the blinking lights I saw were signal lights. From where they were located on mountains, they could not be seen in X-ray, Dylan says. But it was that other light show that mesmerized Dylan, Galloway, and the others aboard the choppers. An elliptical northwest-southeast stream of tiny twinkling lights over half a mile long and 300 yards wide, moving down the face of the massif. The moving lights were no more than half a mile from our foxholes on the perimeter facing the mountain. Galloway, sitting atop a pile of grenade and ammunition crates, was frozen by the twinkling lights. For one heart-stopping moment, he thought he was seeing the muzzle flashes of rifles firing at the two helicopters. Dylan knew better. These lights were being used by the North Vietnamese, hundreds of them, as they moved down the mountain toward the LZ to get in position for attacks in the morning. Artillery was called in on these lights as well as the signal lights on the two mountaintops. Sometime after midnight, there was a large secondary explosion on an area on the mountain's right over X-ray. The Pathfinders momentarily switched on their small shielded landing lights in the little clearing while Tift talked Crandall and Freeman down through the thick curtain of dust and smoke hanging over X-ray. Old Snake and Big Ed powered down into the darkness, clipping the tops of some trees, and within seconds, Dylan, Galloway, and Party bailed out and heaved the ammo boxes and 5-gallon plastic water jugs into the tall grass. Then the two choppers were outbound. Galloway recalls, "We crouched there in the darkness, tried to get our bearings, and waited for someone to come get us. Out of the darkness came a voice. 'Follow me and watch where you step. There's lots of dead people on the ground, and they're all ours.' The voice, which belonged to Sergeant Major Plumley, led us to our command post. I welcomed Galloway with a quick handshake and then briefed Dylan, Whiteside, and Charlie Hastings, the Air Force Forward Air Controller, FAC, while Joe listened. The first order of business was to bring artillery and air down on the locations where the lights had been seen. The second was to make sure that Sergeant Savage and the cutoff platoon were getting all the artillery they needed. Dylan and I discussed how to get to Savage's platoon. Galloway found a tree, leaned back against his pack, and waited. It was a restless night. All the units were on 100% alert. Heron and his Bravo Company troops were into their second straight night without sleep. The enemy commander had at least a rough idea of our strength if he had counted the helicopters coming in during the day, and he knew for a fact that he had whittled us down. A full moon rose at around 11 p.m., giving the enemy commander on Chu Pong a better look at the perimeter. Dylan and I, although grateful that the enemy had not brought any of their anti-aircraft machine guns into play, still feared that they would do so, and soon. We had to keep artillery and air pounding the slopes to suppress those weapons before they could be brought to bear. 37 miles to the northeast, Bruce Crandall and Big Ed Freeman finally shut down their Hueys at a huge helicopter pad, nicknamed the Turkey Farm, outside the wire at Camp Holloway, near Pleiku. They had been flying nonstop since 6 a.m. It was after 10 p.m. when Crandall shut down and tried to get out of the aircraft. That is when the day's activities caught up with me. My legs gave out as I stepped on the skid, and I fell to the ground. For the next few minutes, I vomited. I was very embarrassed, and it took some time to regain my composure. Someone slipped a bottle of cognac into my hand, and I took a big slug. It was a waste of good booze. It came up as fast as it went down. I finally quit shaking and made it to the operations tent to recap the day and plan the next. The aviation unit had quite a day. We had not suffered a single fatality, and we had not left a mission undone. When our infantry brothers called, we hauled. The standard for combat assaults with helicopters had been set on this day. I wondered about tomorrow. Would it be worse? I wasn't sure I could handle another day like today. Then I thought again about the troops in X-ray. The choice was not mine to make.
Bruce Crandall was still steaming over the refusal of the medevac pilot to return to X-ray to haul out the wounded. The officer commanding the medevacs looked me up to chew me out for having led his people into a hot LZ and warned me never to do it again. I couldn't understand how he had the balls to face me when he was so reluctant to face the enemy. If several of my pilots not restrained me, that officer would have earned a righteous Purple Heart that night. From that day forward, I planned every mission in such a manner that the infantry would never have to rely on anyone but my unit for evacuation of their wounded. All of our wounded flown out of X-ray by Crandall's Hueys ended up at Charlie Company, 15th Medical Battalion, 1st Cavalry Division, which was temporarily set up in tents at Camp Holloway. The executive officer of Charlie Med was Captain George H. Kelling, 28, from St. Louis, Missouri. Charlie Med's 5 surgeons tried to stabilize the soldiers coming off the helicopters.
"The treatment we provided," says Kelling, "was designed to keep blood flowing through the patient's system until he could be gotten to a hospital which had the personnel and equipment to perform definitive surgery."
Charlie Med's doctors tied up perforated blood vessels to stop the hemorrhaging and then pumped in whole blood. Kellen recalls that many of the casualties were rapidly bleeding to death, so it was a race against time to get blood into the soldier faster than he was losing it, even while the surgeons were trying to tie off the bleeders.
"We threw caution to the winds and often gave a patient 4 cutdowns, intravenous tubes tied into blood vessels, with 4 corpsmen squeezing the blood bags as hard as they could. It was not unusual for the patient to shiver and quake and lose body temperature from the rapid transfusion of so much cold blood, but the alternative was to let him die."
Army Caribou transport planes from the 17th Aviation Company were standing by, ready to evacuate the stabilized patients from Pleiku to Army hospitals in Quignon and Nha Trang. After additional surgical repairs there, the most serious cases were flown to Clark Field in the Philippines and then on to the United States. Those who were expected to recover within 2 or 3 months were evacuated to Army hospitals in Japan and found themselves back in South Vietnam and back in the field in due course. In landing zone X-ray this first night, the enemy harassed and probed forward of all the companies except for Delta on the east and southeast quadrant of the perimeter. In each case, they were answered by artillery fire or M79 grenades. Our M60 machine gunners were under strict orders not to fire unless ordered to do so. We didn't want to give their locations away. Captain Bob Edwards and his Charlie Company troopers, reinforced by one of Myra and Diderick's platoons, occupied the longest section of the perimeter, which now stretched across 140 yards on the south and southeast sides, tied in with Alpha Company on their right and Delta Company on their left. Says Edwards, "The enemy probes occurred mainly in the vicinity of Lieutenant Lane's position on my right. Small probes of about 5 to 10 enemy. I think they were just trying to feel us out for automatic weapons locations." The troops fired back with M16 and M79 fire. I really did not know what the enemy's capabilities were that night, but I expected anything and told my platoon leaders to keep everyone on 100% alert and to expect an attack. The fact that Charlie Company began fighting right after its arrival had kept the troops on the southern perimeter from digging good foxholes or clearing good fields of fire through the tall grass. The men had hastily dug shallow holes that protected them only if they were prone. Now they had time to dig better holes, but were prevented from doing so by the strict noise discipline ordered at nightfall by Captain Edwards, who didn't want the sounds of digging to give away the American positions or to muffle the noise of enemy movements. Bob Edwards's reinforcements, Lieutenant Lane's 2nd Platoon detached from Myra and Diderick Company, held down Charlie Company's right flank and tied in on their right with Captain Tony Nadal's Alpha Company at the creek bed. They had done what they could to dig in, but it was hard going because of the tangle of tree roots and rocks just beneath the surface of the hard, dry ground. Sergeant John Settlin, having seen to it that his gravely wounded buddy Willard was being taken care of at the aid station, returned to his squad's position before nightfall. Settlin got back, regained his composure, and told Lamont to watch the trees.
"I didn't move my men anymore. I kept everybody down until I could find out where this one sniper was, and sure enough, in about 5 minutes, he made the fatal mistake of swinging out from his tree. He was in a harness and roped very high in a tree. He swung around that tree like an aerial artist in a circus and sprayed fire indiscriminately when he came around. We waited him out and he came by one more time. When he did, we were ready. We eventually shot the cord holding him and he fell to the ground, dead. We were pretty well satisfied he was the one who had shot Willard. They probed us all night long. We had a few men wounded. I had never been in a situation like that. When they would come at us, they would come screaming and we could hear bugles.
Delta Company, now commanded by Lieutenant Larry Litton, held down a shorter section of the line, immediately to the left of Bob Edwards's Charlie Company. Delta was covering the east-southeast sector. The first sergeant of Delta, SFC Warren E. Adams, was in an L-shaped foxhole with Litton and two radio operators. Adams was a veteran of World War II and Korea, and had run his company throughout a long succession of company and platoon commanders. Sergeant Adams had placed the six M60 machine guns of the company next to and tied in with Charlie Company's leftmost unit. Lieutenant Gahagan's second platoon. Those machine guns had flat fields of fire to the south across Gahagan's left flank positions to the southeast and directly east. These six guns constituted a most formidable position, capable of laying down a wall of grazing, interlocking fire. The guns and the gunners behind them would play a key role in defending X-Ray over the next 48 hours. To the left of the six M60 machine guns was the position where the battalion's eight 81mm mortars, now resupplied with hundreds of rounds of ammo, had consolidated. From this position, the mortars could support any section of the perimeter with their high-explosive rounds. The mortar crews were not only responsible for their big tubes, but also had to function as riflemen, helping Delta Company defend that side of the perimeter. To their left, with three more M60 machine guns, was Lieutenant Jim Rackstraw's recon platoon. They were securing the two crippled Huey helicopters sitting on the edge of the perimeter. Specialist Vincent Cantu, who had been appointed a mortar squad leader that afternoon to replace a casualty, was alert and alive, and had every intention of staying that way. He recalls, "That night was just like day, thanks to the guys from the artillery that supported us. By that time, we were all dug in. I had dug me a custom foxhole with space where I could sit and places for all my ammo and grenades and weapons. I had a .45 caliber pistol, an AR-15 rifle, an M79 grenade launcher, and a 15-inch Bowie knife, plus my 81mm mortar and ammo for that. Also 50 feet of nylon rope for river crossings." Captain Myron Duderick's Bravo Company 2nd Battalion, minus Lieutenant Lane's platoon, was on the left of Delta Company and the battalion's mortar pits, protecting the north-northeast sector and helping cover the mortar crews and the small landing zone. "Colonel Moore directed me to occupy the sector extending from the Bravo Company 1st Battalion right flank at the stream bed to Delta Company left flank. The 1st Platoon, led by Lieutenant Cyril R. Rick Rescorla, was on the left, and the 3rd Platoon, led by Lieutenant Ed Vernon, was on the right." Diderick's troops dug in, cleared fields of fire, and prepared for the night. Lieutenant William Lund, the artillery forward observer, had the artillery fire marking rounds and pre-plotted the coordinates for instant barrages. During the night, Diderick's men were harassed by sniper fire and a few minor probes of the perimeter. To the left of Diderick's Bravo Company, 2nd Battalion, were the lines of Captain John Heron's Bravo Company, 1st Battalion, defending north and northwest. Heron recalls his men digging in the best they could. "I told the troops to at least dig prone shelters. A big ditch, the dry creek, provided natural cover. I put my command post in it. The fighting positions were forward of that, however. I put my machine guns in a position to cover my direct front. My perimeter had good grazing fire to the front. Diederik had more of a problem because his terrain was not as open as mine. There were covered approaches leading into his defense line. The enemy could have come up on our side,
but I wasn't apprehensive because we had fired in some real good defensive concentrations, which were so close when we registered them that they blew me around in the ditch. On John Heron's left, defending along the dry creek bed on the western perimeter, was Captain Tony Nadal's Alpha Company. The bulk of Alpha's men were employed holding the crucial creek bed, but a small section of the line now bent sharply south to tie in with Bob Edwards' right flank 20 yards east of the creek bed. Captain Nadal says, "We repulsed short attacks, primarily on my left flank, where the 3rd platoon was, and on the 1st platoon in the center of my line. That attack came between 1 and 2 a.m. Artillery support increased, and I mistakenly believed that the crisis was past." Nadal's new radio operator, Specialist Ray Tanner, said that with the arrival of reinforcements, everyone began feeling a little better about the situation. "While things were quiet, we had lots of time to think about what had taken place during the day. I think we all became men that day. After that afternoon, I don't remember feeling real fear again. We were going to live, and we knew we would win. I remember seeing lights come down the mountain. I got no sleep. There was artillery and mortar rounds going off all night, and small arms fire would flare up every once in a while. It was a very long night." On the Alpha Company perimeter that night, Specialist Bill Beck remembers flares, bugles, fear, talk, thoughts of home, shadows, NVA silhouettes, green enemy tracers. "We were still out in the open, flat on the ground, and the flares would whistle and burn bright and light us up as well. This worried the hell out of me. I lay very still and held my fire." Two other troopers in Nadal's Alpha Company were not so conscientious about maintaining fire discipline. Every few minutes we would hear a plunk as an M79 fired, then the explosion of the 40-millimeter grenade out in front of Alpha Company. Every time this happened, I told Dylan to call Nadal and find out what's happening. Finally, Dylan told Nadal, "If you don't stop that M79 firing, Charlie, the enemy, is going to hit you over the head with a sack of shit." Nadal investigated and reported back. Two of his men were short-timers, men who had only a few days left in the army. They were determined to survive to catch their plane home and were shooting up the bushes with the grenade launcher just in case anyone was out there. They wanted no North Vietnamese sneaking up on them and ruining their travel plans. Out in the bomb-blasted scrub 125 yards due west of the Dry Creek bed in our perimeter, the lost platoon had drained the last drops of water from their canteens and the juice from sea ration tins, and the riflemen, wounded and unwounded, faced the long night with thirst, courage, and trepidation. The men were spread out in two groups inside an oblong east-west perimeter. Ranger Mac McHenry controlled a group of about 6 men in the western part. Sergeant Savage had a dozen other survivors with him in the eastern part. It was purely by chance that Savage, a 3-stripe buck sergeant and junior to Sergeant First Class McHenry, ended up controlling the fight to save Herrick's platoon. He had been closest to the radio when Sergeant Stokes was killed. Although he was only 30 yards away, Savage's boss, SFC McHenry, was completely out of reach. As darkness fell, Savage was on the radio with Lieutenant Bill Riddle, Heron's artillery forward observer, walking the high-explosive barrages all around the cutoff platoon. All of us were lifted off the ground by the impact and covered with dirt and branches. Galen Bungham recalls, "Savage told them on the radio, 'That's right where we want them.' We hollered, 'That was too close.' But I looked back where those first rounds hit and saw 3 men running toward us. We opened up. They must have been crawling up on our position when that artillery came in. They would sneak in as close as 10 yards or less, and many times just stand up and laugh at us. We would mow them down. It begins to work on your mind. What are they laughing at? I couldn't believe it." Anytime Savage heard the enemy moving in the brush, he brought artillery down on them, and often had the satisfaction of hearing their shouts and screams after the explosions. The sniper fire faded away at sunset, and the enemy attacks lessened once the artillery ring was drawn around the platoon. John Heron, Matt Dillon, Sergeant Larry Gilreath, and others kept in close radio contact with Savage throughout the night.
I took my turn talking with him, says Gilreath. We both got pretty choked up, but I told him to hang on, and we would see him tomorrow.
Dillon had previously commanded Bravo Company for 18 months, and he knew most of the men in Herrick's platoon personally. He talked with Savage often during the night. More than 5 miles northeast of X-Ray, at Landing Zone Falcon, my battalion's Rear Area Headquarters detachment monitored and logged every radio transmission on the battalion net. My executive officer, Major Herman L. Worth, a Pennsylvanian, commanded there. It was standard operating procedure for a battalion in the field to set up a small rear area headquarters commanded by the battalion executive officer. This rear headquarters was responsible for keeping the battalion supplied with everything it needed and for keeping track of communications, casualties evacuated, and the 100 other little but very important details that an infantry battalion commander has no time to deal with during a shootout. In the operations tent, Lieutenant Richard Merchant of Pontiac, Michigan, was in charge, assisted by Master Sergeant Raymond L. Wills of the Intelligence Section and Master Sergeant Noel Blackwell of the Operations Section. Merchant had spent more than a year with Bravo Company under both Dillon and Heron. My emotions welled high. I had been leader of 2nd Platoon B Company during the entire airmobile test phase and knew all but the very new replacements. The sergeants in the cutoff platoon were like family to me. We had soldiered together. Major Worth, sensing my distress, suggested that I take a break from the radio. The North Vietnamese launched 3 separate attacks to keep the pressure on the trapped 2nd Platoon during that long night, each time sending about 50 men against the Americans and each time being beaten back by artillery and rifle fire. Savage had 7 men unhurt and 13 wounded. 9 others were dead. Some of the lost platoon's wounded continued to fight, including Sergeant Reuben Thompson, who had been shot through the chest. Savage would call us and say, "I hear them forming up below me, and I'm sure they are going to attack in a matter of minutes." The men in the platoon later told me they were sure the enemy had run all the way through their positions during the night attacks, says Captain Heron. They were such a small group, it was dark, and the enemy had to contend with so much artillery. I don't think they were sure of the platoon's exact location. The first attack before midnight came just as Savage's men heard troops heading for the landing zone on 2 large trails, one to the American south and one to their north. This attack was beaten off by the riflemen and by Savage's employment of the artillery barrages. At around 3:15 a.m., a series of bugle calls sounded, first faintly, then loudly, up on the mountain and around Savage's platoon. The forward air controller, Charlie Hastings, immediately called for Air Force flare illumination and called down airstrikes on the slopes above Savage. The flares and airstrikes all arrived within 20 minutes, just before and during the second attack on the lost platoon, and helped break up the attack. Savage, though grateful for the assistance, asked John Heron to call off the flares because the trapped men were afraid the bright light would expose their precariously held positions. But in the light of the last flares dropped that night, they saw North Vietnamese scurrying around the rough clearing, dragging their dead and wounded into the trees. The platoon later heard still another large enemy force noisily moving down the northern trail toward X-Ray, and once again brought artillery fire down on them. This was followed by a flurry of hand grenades back and forth at about 4:30 a.m. Within an hour, the first light in the eastern sky revealed dozens of khaki-clad enemy dead scattered all around the little knoll. The trapped platoon had survived the longest night any of them would ever know. They checked their ammunition and prepared to receive a dawn attack. Chapter 12. A Dawn Attack. A brave captain is as a root, out of which as branches the courage of his soldiers doth spring. Sir Philip Sidney. It was 6:20 a.m., Monday, November 15th, and in the half-light before dawn, the battalion operations officer, Captain Matt Dillon, knelt rummaging through his field pack for the makings of C-ration hot chocolate. An uneasy feeling nagged at me as I stood nearby, peering into the calm dimness around the clearing. It had nothing to do with Sergeant Savage and the lost platoon.
They had survived the night without further casualties, and Dylan and I worked out a new plan for the rescue. No. It was something else that bothered me. It was too quiet. Too still. Turning to Dylan, I told him to order all companies to immediately send out reconnaissance patrols forward of their positions to check for enemy activity. Dylan put out that order while his radio man specialist for Robert McCollum's fired up a heat tab under a canteen cup of water for their hot chocolate. While the patrols were preparing to ease out of the perimeter to check for enemy infiltrators, I told Dylan to radio all the company commanders to meet us at Bob Edwards's command post just behind the Charlie Company lines to discuss the best attack route out to Savage. I had decided we would try to break through using three companies, John Heron's Bravo, Tony Nadal's Alpha, and Bob Edwards's Charlie, deployed in a wedge formation. I would be with Bravo, leaving Dylan in charge of the LZ. We would jump off from the dry creek bed after heavy close-in air and artillery prep fires and keep the artillery walking just ahead of us as we moved west toward Savage's platoon. Diderick and Litton's companies would remain behind in reserve to protect the small landing area. It was a good plan, but it never happened. Captain Bob Edwards remembers, "At first light, Colonel Moore was planning to attack to reach the cutoff platoon. The company commanders were to meet at my command post to discuss this. He also directed us to patrol out from our positions for possible snipers or infiltrators that had closed in on the perimeter during the night. I passed this on to my platoon leaders and told them to send a squad from each of the four platoons out about 200 yards. The patrols from 2nd Platoon, Lieutenant Gehagen, and 1st Platoon, Lieutenant Kroger, had moved about 150 yards in the search when they began receiving heavy small arms fire. They returned fire and started back. Gehagen's platoon sergeant, Robert Jemison, recalls that just before daybreak, he and Lieutenant Gehagen shared the last few drops of water in a canteen. Their other three canteens were bone dry. "At first light, we sent out a patrol, Staff Sergeant Sidney Cohen, Specialist 4 Arthur L. Bronson, and three other men were picked to go," said Jemison. "They saved us from being surprised. They spotted the enemy on their way in to attack our position. They came running back with Bronson screaming, 'They're coming, Sarge, a lot of them. Get ready.' I told the machine gunners to hold their fire until they were close." At the battalion command post, the attack shattered the early morning stillness like a huge explosion. The intense heavy firing told us with jolting clarity that the south and southeast sections of the X-ray perimeter were under extremely heavy attack. I yelled to Dylan to call in all the firepower he could get. Fire swept across the landing zone and into my command post. It was 6:50 a.m. Then Lieutenant Colonel Huang Phuong, who was present in the Ya Drang and wrote the North Vietnamese after-action report on the fight, says, "We had planned to launch our attack at 2 a.m., but because of airstrikes and part of the battalion getting lost, it was delayed until 6:30 a.m. The attack was carried out by the 7th Battalion of the 66th Regiment. The H-15 Main Force Battalion, a local force Viet Cong unit, was also in that attack." Bob Edwards was on the radio desperately trying to get information from his four platoons. The heaviest firing was in the vicinity of his 1st and 2nd platoons, who were holding down the left side of the lines. He could not get either Lieutenant Kroger or Lieutenant Gehagen on the radio. Only Lieutenant Franklin and Lieutenant Lane, whose platoons held the right side, responded. They were in good shape. Captain Edwards and the five men sharing the command post foxhole began shooting at the onrushing enemy. Moments later, there was a desperate radio call from Edwards. "I need help!" I told him no, he would have to hold with his own resources and firepower for the time being. It would be tactically unsound, even suicidal, to commit my small reserve force so quickly, before we got a feel for what the enemy was doing elsewhere around the perimeter. Charlie Company was obviously in a heavy fight, but they had not been penetrated. Bob Edwards estimated that his men were being attacked by two or three companies, and to make things worse, a large number of the enemy had closed with Gehagen and Kroger's two platoons before the artillery and air could be brought to bear. The North Vietnamese were now safely inside the Ring of Steel.
My command post and Alpha and Bravo companies, directly across the flat open ground behind Edwards' foxholes, were now catching the enemy grazing fire, which passed through and over the Charlie Company lines. The Bravo Company commander, John Heron, says, "I alerted my men to be ready to swing around and defend in the opposite direction if the enemy broke through into the perimeter behind us." In Alpha Company, Captain Adal's radio operator, Specialist Tanner, remembers, "When morning broke, it all started over again. I remember using a big log for cover. Every once in a while, I would see muzzle flashes in the trees. We would fire at any muzzle blast seen." Bob Edwards could not raise Lieutenant Kroger or Lieutenant Gehagen on his radio because the two platoon leaders and their men were fighting for their lives, blazing away at the onrushing enemy. Sergeant Jemison said Gehagen's troops were in two-man, foot-deep holes spaced about 10 yards apart, in which they could lie prone. Jemison says, "The enemy was wearing helmets with nets on them and grass stuck in the netting. They looked like little trees. There were over 100 of them, hitting our right flank hard and over in the first platoon. Gehagen's foxhole and mine were in about the center of our position. They hit us once, then fell back. Then they split into two groups. One began trying to flank us on the left, but Specialist Ford James Comer's machine gun stopped them. The other kept hitting the right. One of the first men to get hit was Sergeant Cohen to my right. Then other people got wounded." PFC Willie F. Godbolt, 24, of Jacksonville, Florida, was hit while firing from his position 20 yards to Sergeant Jemison's right. Jemison remembers, "Godbolt was hollering, 'Somebody help me.' I yelled, 'I'll go get him.' Lieutenant Gehagen yelled back, 'No, I will.' Gehagen moved out of his position in the foxhole to help Godbolt and was shot. This was 10 minutes or so from the time the firing first broke out." Struck in the back and the head, Lieutenant John Lance Jack Gehagen was killed instantly. The man he was trying to save, PFC Godbolt, died of his wound shortly afterward. The enemy now closed to within 75 yards of Edwards' line. They were firing furiously, some crouched low and at times crawling on their hands and knees. Others, no taller than the elephant grass they were passing through, came on standing up and shooting. They advanced screaming at each other and at Edwards' men. Leaders were blowing whistles and using hand and arm signals. A few were even carrying 82-millimeter mortar tubes and base plates. This was clearly no hit-and-run affair. They had come to stay. Specialist 4 Arthur Vieira Jr., 22, of Riverside, Rhode Island, was armed with an M79 grenade launcher and a .45-caliber pistol. "Once the firing started, out with the patrol, it all happened fast. They were into us in about 10 minutes. I remember one guy hollering, 'Look at 'em all, look at 'em all.' There were at least 200 of them coming at us fast. I yelled at him to start firing and shoved him in a foxhole. I kept firing with my M79. Our medic was shot in both legs and going crazy, trying to push himself up from the ground with his arms." Sergeant Jemison says, "We had one man run into our positions from the first platoon. He was shot in the head and hollered to me, 'Damn, Sergeant, they are messing us up.'" Jemison says one of his squads, under Sergeant Reginald A. Watkins, 25, of Charlotte, North Carolina, was on the far right next to Kroger's first platoon and was virtually wiped out when Kroger's platoon was hit so hard. Sergeant Watkins was among the dead. Playing a key role in keeping Gehagen's platoon from being overrun were two M60 machine guns, one manned by Specialist James C. Comer of Sea Grove, North Carolina, and Specialist 4 Clinton S. Poley, and the other operated by Specialist 4 George Fox of Rocky Mount, North Carolina, and Specialist 4 Nathaniel Byrd of Jacksonville, Florida. Comer and Poley were on the left, Byrd and Fox were off to the right, next to the first platoon. Comer's gun interlocked its field of fire with that of Delta Company on the left, while Byrd and Fox interlocked their fire with that of the first platoon. Those two machine guns kept cutting down the enemy. Now Bob Edwards' third platoon, led by Lieutenant Franklin, came under attack, but fortunately, with nothing like the numbers or ferocity of the assault against Kroger's and Gehagen's platoons. A heavy firefight developed on Franklin's right, involving Lieutenant Lane's reinforcing platoon from Bravo Company 2nd Battalion. Sergeant John Settlin was in that scrap.
It seemed like half a battalion hit us all at once. He hit us headlong and he hit us strong. I thought we were going to be overrun. When Charlie hit us, he had a strange grazing fire. He shot right at ground level, trying to cut your legs off, or if you weren't deep enough in your foxhole, he shot your head off. When he started firing at us, it came like torrents of rain. You couldn't get your head up long enough to shoot back. You just stuck your weapon up, pulled the trigger, and emptied the magazine.
Back at the battalion command post, I had my ear glued to the radio handset when Captain Bob Edwards' voice broke in with a quick, curt, "I'm hit." I asked him how bad it was and whether he could still function. He replied that he was down and his left arm was useless, but he would do his best to carry on. Specialist 4 Ernie Paolone, sharing the foxhole with his boss, says Edwards was bleeding badly from the back of his left shoulder and left armpit. Edwards' commo sergeant, Sergeant Herman R. Hostutler, was hit in the neck and went down, bleeding heavily. Edwards then saw two or three enemy right in front of us. I stood, threw a grenade, and immediately felt a tremendous hard slap on my back. I found myself on the ground inside the foxhole. I had lost the ability to move my left arm, but otherwise was conscious. I called Colonel Moore and told him what happened and asked that he send my executive officer up to take command. Edwards' executive officer was Lieutenant John W. Arrington, 23, a native of North Carolina and a graduate of West Point, class of 1964. I called him over from the ammo storage area, briefed him, and told him to move out and take over Charlie Company. Arrington headed out at a low, crouching run across 50 yards of open ground toward the company command post. Now Edwards was on the radio to Matt Dillon, telling him he was very worried about the enemy exploiting their penetration. When I saw this enemy right in front of my position, I knew I needed at least another platoon to assist me. I needed somebody up there to plug the gap. I tried to convince Dillon that my need was as great as anyone's because I was stretched thin. I pushed the other two platoons over to try and plug this gap. They tried, but were under too much fire to do it effectively. The penetration Edwards was talking about was in Lieutenant Neil Kroger's first platoon position directly in front of Bob Edwards' command post foxhole. The enemy had obviously burst through at that point. Edwards' artillery forward observer was pinned down in the command post foxhole, unable to adjust the fires. The battalion fire support coordinator, Captain Jerry Whiteside, calmly stood up, peered over the termite hill in the face of enemy fire, and adjusted the artillery and aerial rocket gunship fire forward of Charlie Company. Lieutenant Charlie Hastings, our forward air controller, had already swung into action. Sensing disaster, Hastings made an immediate, instinctive decision. "I used the code word broken arrow, which meant American unit in contact and in danger of being overrun, and we received all available aircraft in South Vietnam for close air support. We had aircraft stacked at 1,000-foot intervals from 7,000 feet to 35,000 feet, each waiting to receive a target and deliver their ordnance." Now it was 7:15 a.m., and suddenly fighting broke out in front of the Delta Company machine guns and mortar positions. It was a separate heavy assault on a section of the perimeter immediately to the left of Edwards' Charlie Company. Initial reports estimated two companies of enemy, many dressed in black uniforms. It was a Viet Cong battalion, the H-15 Main Force Battalion, making its first appearance on the battlefield. Delta Company's first sergeant, Warren Adams, a three-war veteran, was dug in on the perimeter. He remembers, "There were enemies who sneaked up and hit us. My radio operator and I kept getting fragments from hand grenades popping all around us. One of them hit our fire direction center foxhole, and Sergeant Walter Niemeyer's leg was blown off. My radio operator and I decided to clean up a termite hill where the grenades were coming from. We each pulled the pins on two grenades, one in each hand, and packed off through the trees and brush, got on the backside of the hill and tossed them over. Sure enough, two or three bodies, clothing, a couple of AK-47s were back there when we looked. One must have been an officer. We picked up his pistol." Specialist 4 George McDonald, a Charlie Company mortarman, was beside his mortar near Sergeant Adams' position. "When our perimeter was attacked, it was so close that we weren't able to use the mortars.
I was told to use my M79 and hand grenades and was pleased with the results. I remember talking to a new trooper who had just joined the army. He told me that he was only 17 years old. A short time later, a rocket round hit a tree close by and riddled his back with shrapnel. He had on a white T-shirt, and I bet that it was the only white shirt in the 1st Cavalry Division.
All the cavalry troopers had dyed their underwear army green on orders before they sailed for Vietnam.
The last I heard was that he had been evacuated.
Across the clearing, hugging the ground under the hail of fire snapping through the battalion command post, was reporter Joe Galloway.
I was down flat, clutching my rifle, expecting at any moment to see the enemy break through into the clearing. I could see blips of dust where rounds hit and an occasional rocket grenade or small mortar explosion. In the middle of all that, a kid wearing a white T-shirt stumbled out of the trees, lurching toward us. We all started yelling and waving to him to go back to cover. He kept coming, but finally saw us.
When he turned around, we could see his back was shredded, the red blood a startling sight against the white shirt. He later made it to the battalion aid station.
By now, I was convinced that the enemy was making a primary effort to overrun us from the south and southeast, and I alerted the reserve platoon for probable commitment into the Charlie or Delta Company sectors.
The noise of battle was unbelievable. Never before or since, in two wars, have I heard anything to equal it. I wanted to get help to Bob Edwards, but decided it was still too early in the game to commit the reserve force. Instead, I told Dillon to direct Captain Tony Nadal of Alpha Company to quickly move a platoon across the clearing to reinforce Charlie Company. Not wanting to weaken his critical left flank, which was closest to Charlie Company and was holding that sharp left turn in the line just east of the creek bed, Nadal chose to pull out his right flank 2nd platoon, Joe Marm's unit, now led by Platoon Sergeant George McCulley, and send them over to help Edwards. Nadal then ordered his 3rd platoon leader, Sergeant Lorenzo Nathan, to stretch his men out to fill the gap left by the departure of McCulley's men. McCulley and his 16 men, all that were left of Lieutenant Marm's platoon, came through the battalion command post. I briefed the sergeant and pointed out where Edwards' command post was located. McCulley and his men headed out at a low crouch, moving fast in short bounds across the open ground under heavy enemy automatic weapons fire. They lost 2 killed and 2 wounded, including Sergeant McCulley, who was wounded in the neck, during the dangerous move, but finally made it to the right center of the Charlie Company sector, about 15 yards behind their lines. There, taking up positions that gave them good fields of fire, the remnants of the 2nd platoon men provided some measure of defense in depth to Charlie Company. But the loss of 4 men crossing the clearing convinced me that further internal movements were inadvisable until we reduced the enemy grazing fire. Unnoticed at my command post because of the deafening uproar from the Charlie and Delta Company sectors was a stiff little firefight taking place 40 yards north, involving Specialist Wilenius and his fellow Bravo Company 2nd Battalion mortarmen.
About 6:50 a.m., I observed a soldier in a khaki uniform with helmet and web gear stand up to our front and pump his arm up and down. He was in waist-high grass and obviously signaling. I alerted Sergeant Uselton in time for us to see 4 more helmeted troops rise from the grass to our left and cross right, carrying a light machine gun. We were convinced we were behind friendly troops and assumed that these strange, well-disciplined soldiers must be Australians. We radioed back and learned that there were no Aussies with us, and our front was not protected. About then, the North Vietnamese machine gun opened up on us. There was a small tree that formed a Y 4 feet from the ground about 30 yards to the left. It was from there that the machine gun squad had slipped from cover and ran across our front. I saw a man's head peer out between the Y and snapped off a quick shot. A second or two later, the head reappeared and I took a more careful single shot at it. I was surprised when the head showed again in the same spot. I'm a good shot and this was close. I took a shooting range stance and fired again. Again the head disappeared, then reappeared. I stood there and kept shooting this pop-up target. I fired 10 more times, methodical single shots, until the pop-up target range closed down.
Wallenius's attention now shifted toward the right,
where the mortar pits had come under direct fire from the enemy machine gun. All three mortar pits knocked over their tubes so that the machine gun wouldn't have a direct fix on their positions in the tall grass. The enemy gun team was placed between Sergeant Alvarez Buzo and Sergeant James Gother's 2nd Squad mortar pits. Sergeant James Ratledge and his 1st Squad crew, along with Gother and the 2nd Squad, had managed to withdraw their men and guns right under the nose of a firing machine gun. That left Alvarez Buzo and two men still in position. We were afraid to lay down fire for fear of hitting them. Ratledge made an attempt to put M79 fire on the machine gun. This distraction allowed PFC Fred S. Bush to make a run for it, and he headed toward our regrouped positions, followed by PFC Jose Gonzalez. Bush made it, but Gonzalez was hit several times. Ratledge and several others were wounded from grenade shrapnel that seemed to be buzzing all over. We got to Bush and Gonzalez. Bush said that Alvarez Buzo was still in the mortar pit wounded. Without hesitation, Virgie Hibbler dropped his web gear and started to crawl toward the 3rd Squad mortar pit. I followed him. We got about halfway, 15 yards, and the machine gun started firing at the moving grass over our heads. We reached the mortar pit, a shallow 2-yard circle not more than 10 feet from the machine gun. He was still firing too high. Alvarez Buzo looked dead. I didn't see any obvious wound, but he wasn't breathing and we couldn't feel a pulse. Hibbler and Wilenius weren't done yet. Wilenius says, "We crawled back and reported Alvarez was dead. When asked where he had been hit, we had no answer. Some doubt surfaced as to whether he was dead or maybe that we hadn't actually been there. This was our platoon's first casualty and no one wanted to believe it. Somebody said, you could put a mirror under their nostrils and it would fog and prove he was alive. Sure enough, somebody had a mirror. Virgie led again and we crawled back out to Alvarez Buzo to make sure. The mirror didn't fog up, but still we weren't sure. The machine gun had ignored us this time, so we decided to take Alvarez Buzo back. He weighed about 200 pounds. The machine gun immediately got our range again. Just when they figured out exactly where we were, our guys saw us and opened up on them. Everyone now agreed that Sergeant Alvarez Buzo was indeed dead. With no friendlies around the machine gun, we decided to dispatch it with hand grenades. After the second grenade, the fire stopped. Sergeant Elias Alvarez Buzo from Ponce, Puerto Rico, was 25 years old when he was killed. The enemy commander was getting better at this. His attacks on Charlie and Delta companies were well planned and came close to achieving complete surprise. And, unlike the first day when he committed his forces piecemeal, today he threw perhaps as many as 1,000 men against us in a 25-minute span. Then, too, I had spent too much time worrying about Herrick's platoon and how to rescue them. I should have paid more attention to the enemy's capabilities. If I had, I would have gotten the H-13 scout helicopters up at first light, sweeping the approaches at low level and looking for the enemy. Clearly, the enemy commander had moved his troops and reinforcements all night to get them in position. His objective was to position his assault force right under our noses, so close that our artillery could not be effectively used and then smash through Charlie Company's lines and on out into the open clearing. With that, he could then roll right into the battalion command post and attack into the rear of Alpha and Bravo companies. Only the recon patrols at first light averted complete disaster. The enemy troops had Gehagen's and Kroger's understrength platoons in a deadly bear hug. Americans and North Vietnamese were dying by the dozens in the storm of fire. The bloody hole in the ground that was Bob Edwards's command post was crowded with men. Sergeant Herman Hostetler lay crumpled in the dirt, now dead. Specialist 4 Ernie Paolone crouched low, bleeding from a shrapnel wound in his left arm. Sergeant James P. Castleberry, the artillery forward observer, Castleberry's radio operator, PFC Irvin L. Brown Jr., the only unwounded man in the hole, hunched down beside Paolone. Bob Edwards, shot through the left shoulder and armpit, slumped, unable to move, in a contorted sitting position with his radio handset held to his right ear. "I continued to command as best I could," Edwards says. An automatic weapon had the CP foxhole zeroed in, and we lay there watching bullets kick dirt off the small parapet around the edge of the hole. Edwards didn't know how badly he had been hurt, only that he couldn't stand up. The two platoons he had radio contact with continued to report that they were under fire but had not been penetrated. No one answered the captain's calls in the two worst-hit platoons, and the enemy had penetrated to within hand-grenade range of Edwards' foxhole.